Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at American Mary, which had its initial release in 2012 at the London Frightfest Film Festival before coming to theaters and video on demand in 2013. Written and directed by Jen and Sylvia Soska, sometimes credited as the Soska sisters or the Twisted Twins. I feel like describing them as directors is almost too limiting, though. They're really more like a pair of performance artists and professional provocateurs who use film as one of the venues for their creative personas. They also hosted a game show for two seasons called Hellevator, in which they very much stayed in character as debauched, sinister, possibly incestuous twins who enjoyed pushing boundaries and creating discomfort. Incidentally, I want to make it very clear here, I think it is fair to say that the characters the Soskas present in their various public appearances are intended to be viewed as possibly incestuous, because again, they are boundary pushers and provocateurs, but this should in no way be taken to read as any kind of actual assertion about their private lives and personal relationships. Fiction is fiction, and reality is reality, and it never does well to confuse the two. Unfortunately, their determination to push boundaries and create discomfort has come back to bite them at times. In 2019, when they remade David Cronenberg's cult classic horror movie Rabid, they were banned from Twitter for posting gory images from the film. This led them to make common cause with a number of figures from the alt-right in the name of quote-unquote free speech, exactly as it became obvious to everyone that the alt-right in America had become a fully fascist movement dedicated to overthrowing the United States government, and the way they cozied up to figures like Jack Posobiec then led to some further conversations about their association with disgraced and abusive director Lucifer Valentine. They claim they never worked with him, but they are on camera in one of his movies even if they're not credited, so that claim is a little difficult to believe, and some allegations about hostile environments on their sets, which are unfortunately a little difficult to pin down. That's because the Soskas decided to almost entirely vanish from social media in the wake of the controversy, denying these discussions any oxygen, and they now limit themselves to posting updates on their projects and pictures of themselves walking their dogs. I'm not sure how to feel about any of this, to be honest, but it does seem safe to say that they haven't always known how far was too far, and everybody should post more pictures of adorable dogs on social media. American Mary was their second movie. Their first, Dead Hooker in a Trunk, was made as a student film project in a salute to grindhouse filmmaking, and I think gives you a pretty good idea of their relationship to deliberately shocking and provocative material just from that title. They came up with the idea for American Mary while trying to sell Trunk, as they dealt with one untrustworthy distributor after another and came to feel very much like they were being courted for their personal attributes more than the project they brought to the table. The Soskas have developed something of a reputation for what I guess you could call feminist revenge fantasies, if that doesn't come across as too pejorative. In addition to American Mary, which has some very big this-is-what-you-get-if-you-come-at-a-woman vibes, they also did a Black Widow series for Marvel where the character took on a human trafficking ring that sold women into prostitution. There's something of a theme here. The film was independently financed, with Marius and Agnes Soska following the same route as Don Coscarelli's parents and backing the project with their own personal money, and it was shot in Vancouver despite being set in Seattle to take advantage of the exchange rate and the generous tax breaks we've talked about in numerous episodes. I may have mentioned this before, but my roommate grew up in Vancouver, and to this day he gets deeply amused when watching just about any production from the last 50 years attempting to pass recognizable Vancouver landmarks off as a variety of other cities and futuristic destinations. And for those of you who might have heard a few things about this film and wondered about its treatment of body modification, the Soskas worked with body modification artist Russ Fox to ensure that the procedures were depicted medically accurately and with all due sensitivity, and most of the minor roles in the film are portrayed by either Fox himself or clients of his who've undergone the procedures involved. I think there are some issues with this aspect of the story, and I'll get into them as they arise, but I think it comes down squarely on the right side of the question of bodily autonomy as it relates to elective surgical procedures. Starring in the film as Mary Mason is the amazing Catherine Isabel. We've discussed her career back in our episode on Freddy vs. Jason, where she played the poor doomed Gib, but it's worth mentioning once again what a fantastic career she's had over the years. She got her start as a child actor, doing a lot of film and television, including Goosebumps, MacGyver, and a particular favorite thriller of mine, the 1992 movie Night Moves. It was one of the early waves of post-Silence of the Lambs taunting serial killer movies, and pulls off a neat trick by making its protagonist so shifty and antagonistic that you really do wonder if they're doing a double bluff and he's been the villain all along. But she managed the difficult transition to adult roles, appearing as Ginger in Ginger Snaps, before going on to dozens of appearances on film and television all the way up to 2023's It's a Wonderful Knife, which was made by the same people who made Freaky, and which will make an appearance on this podcast the second I can snag a copy. Mary was specifically written for her. Apparently, she met the Soska sisters while they were appearing as extras together in the movie Josie and the Pussycats, and they struck up a friendship. Appearing as Billy Barker, the sketchy owner of the nightclub whose criminal activities become crucial to events, is Antonio Cupo. He's a native of Vancouver who's appeared in a number of film and television roles, and one thing I will say about the Vancouver tax credits, their requirements regarding local talent have given a lot of working actors plenty of jobs and chances to get their faces out into the public eye, and while I'd say this is probably Cupo's signature role, genre fans might also recognize him from The Curse of La Llorona. Tristan Risk, who plays Beatrice, doesn't exactly get her face into the public eye in this movie, appearing in hefty makeup that, well, we'll get to that, I promise. But she's definitely got a hefty and memorable role in the film. It's part of a whole career of genre movies, beginning with Killer Babes and the Frightening Film Fiasco, and proceeding up through Happily Ever Evil, House of Manson, ABCs of Death 2, Frankenstein-created Bikers, the aforementioned remake of Rabid, all the way up through 2023's The Black Mass. Clearly an actor after our own horror-loving hearts. The two sleazy doctors who shaped Mary's career to disastrous effect, well, disastrous for them at least, are David Lovegren's Dr. Grant and Clay St. Thomas's Dr. Walsh. Lovegren is also a Vancouver native, and he has one of those very Canadian IMDb pages we love so much. He got his start as a day player on an episode of 21 Jump Street, and showed up in The X-Files, Poltergeist the Legacy, The New Addams Family, The Crow Stairway to Heaven, The Outer Limits, Supernatural, Andromeda, Smallville, and Stargate SG-1. So basically, he's got one of those faces you're bound to recognize, even if you have to look him up to find out where you know him from. St. Thomas has had a very similar career. The shows might be a little different, with Legends of Tomorrow and V instead of The X-Files and Smallville, but there's a lot of one-episode roles and brief appearances in genre movies that shot in Canada for tax purposes. You'd probably be more likely to recognize his voice than his face, though. He's done quite a bit of voice work, including acting as the announcer on Lego Ninjago, which scans perfectly to the tune of Lady Madonna by the Beatles. Get that out of your head for the rest of the day. Playing a brief but very key role as Ruby Real Girl, the woman whose surgery sets Mary on her path, is Paula Lindbergh. She doesn't have a ton of credits, but she has done some English dubbing for anime series like Shakugan no Shana and The Story of Sayonkoku, and for some American TV shows as well, notably Iron Man Armored Adventures. And of course, like virtually anybody living in Vancouver between 2005 and 2020, she was in an episode of Supernatural. Playing the somewhat thankless role of Detective Dolar is John Emmett Tracy. We'll get to why it's thankless soon enough, I promise. Tracy is somehow not Canadian, despite roles in Supernatural, Smallville, and the TV show version of The Dead Zone, but I presume he's an honorary Canadian nonetheless. He's actually from Chicago. He's been a regular on iZombie, Batwoman, and most recently Yellowstone. And finally, we have Twan Holliday, who totally steals his one major scene as hulking bouncer Lance. He hasn't done a lot of acting, but he's not easily forgotten due to his physique. So if you're watching an episode of Stan Helsing or Stargate Atlantis or Psych, and you see a guy who looks like Lemmy from Motorhead ate all of Popeye's spinach, you know who you're probably seeing. And believe me when I say he's fantastic in this film. Speaking of, before we begin, I do have to offer some trigger warnings. This film depicts realistic sequences of surgery and extreme body modification, as well as rape and sexual assault, and those topics unfortunately do require discussion if we're to unpack the story's message. If you're not up for those conversations, I understand, and this would be a good place to leave off listening to the episode until you're feeling up for those topics. If you need help, you can always dial 988 to get to a suicide and crisis lifeline 24 hours a day. With that understood, let's get into it. The film opens, after the credits, with shots of a woman's hands cutting and stitching and suturing flesh as Ave Maria plays in the background. Ave Maria is, of course, Hail Mary, making it the lead character's personal theme. It's shot in such detailed close-up as to seem horrifyingly gruesome, but it doesn't take long to notice that the skin seems suspiciously loose and goose-pimpled, and the opened incisions appear to be white meat and not red, and aren't bleeding. And sure enough, this is Mary Mason practicing her surgical skills on a turkey she bought from the butcher. She's clearly skilled and dexterous, Catherine Isabel supposedly practiced to be able to do these scenes without a hand double, and as we see in the next scene where her professor Dr. Grant tries to embarrass her in class for being unprepared and she deftly volleys his pop quiz right back to him, she's also brilliant. But as we see immediately after the lecture, she's having money problems. Her student loan company is calling her, her cell phone is about to be shut off for non-payment of bills, and she doesn't have any immediate way of making up the $364 shortfall that will keep the phone turned on. I think a lot of folks can at least relate to this. You're a very lucky person if you've never had a moment where there's too much month at the end of the money, and this scene really does strike hard to anyone who's experienced that. And almost immediately, by the way, we are being given not just a tour de force performance from Catherine Isabel, but a very clear picture of who Mary Mason is as a person from that performance. In just this brief sequence above, she goes from being simperingly flirtatious with her professor when she thinks his ego needs salving, to displaying icy, brisk competence when he stings her intellectual pride. She likewise flips back and forth between bubbly, oops, I guess I made a boo-boo, affected childishness when talking to the cell phone company, and cold, no-nonsense brusqueness when she can't negotiate a smaller payoff fee. In short, Mary's someone who has learned how to present the face the world wants to see from her to survive, and it's anyone's guess how much of her demeanor is a mask in any given scene. With limited options, Mary decides to try sex work to make up her shortfall, researching local strip clubs and adult modeling opportunities while she chats in a mix of Hungarian and English with her grandmother about television shows and similar mundane details of daily life. It's not hard to imagine that these conversations were drawn from the Saska sisters' own experiences growing up. Finding a place called the Bourbon A-Go-Go, she emails them asking for an interview and shows up that same night wearing a trench coat over a much more revealing outfit to speak with the owner Billy Barker, named after Clive Barker in a nod to the film's very horny body horror themes. Billy isn't interested in the resume she brought in. He wants to see what she looks like under her coat, how she walks up and down the stage, and what kind of skills she has with sensual massage. But the movie takes a 900-mile-per-hour left turn when Lance, Billy's enforcer, interrupts to mention that a man named Black isn't answering his cell phone and his skills are rather vitally needed in short order. Technically, it's a bit more coarse than that. The word clusterfuck is in fact used, but you get the gist. Having just read Mary's CV, he knows that she's in med school and very close to starting her residency, so he offers her a quick $5,000 to stitch up a man named Rat, who has a nasty knife wound from his sternum all the way up to his chin. She does the job and takes the money, then goes home and crawls into the shower fully clothed to wash the blood off before sleeping on the couch with a baseball bat and the front door to her apartment triple locked. I love, love, love the way Rat's screams and whimpers literally follow her all the way home on the soundtrack. This is all, just to clarify, less than 15 minutes into the hour and 42-minute runtime of this film. One of American Mary's simultaneous virtues and flaws is that it does not slow down for anything, moving with such breakneck speed from one plot development to the next that sometimes major events are barely even mentioned because there's simply no time to show them before we get on to the next important story point. The Saska sisters have announced that they're developing a television version of this story, and I think that's a really good thing because, while I love the big, wide swerves that characterize the story, I do kind of feel like just about everything in this movie needs more time to breathe. Having finally accepted that she's not about to die at the hands of a bunch of criminals trying to cover their tracks, Mary's then startled out of her mind by a phone call from a woman named Beatrice, who asks in a very high, girlish voice if Dr. Mason is available. Tristan Risk modeled her vocal performance on Ellen Green in the 1986 musical version of Little Shop of Horrors, and boy, I tell ya, she could do looping for Green's performance, and I wouldn't know the difference. Mary hangs up, then hangs up again when the woman calls back, then gets another call from her actual job at a local restaurant telling her that they're closed for good and she's out of work. She responds to this by getting distracted and drunk, which may be why she doesn't notice that the delivery driver buzzing her to drop off a package sounds so suspiciously familiar. But sure enough, Beatrice, who we caught just a tiny glimpse of back at the club, shows up looking uncannily like cartoon character Betty Boop and asking for a little favor. She's had 14 surgeries to make herself look the way she does, and she needs something similar done for a friend. She found Mary's resume at the club, complete with phone number and address, and she wants to talk to her about doing some extreme body modification. It's technically plastic surgery, what's sometimes called cosmetic or aesthetic surgery, but it's not a procedure that many doctors would sign off on, and Beatrice and her friend are trying to get creative. She offers Mary $200 just for listening to the conversation, a further $2,000 for a consultation after hours at a local veterinary clinic, and a whopping $10,000 if she'll actually do the operation. Mary is understandably leery, but she's also very broke, despite the $5,000 she just got from Billy, and worried about her academic future based on a phone call she gets from Dr. Grant scolding her about a missed lecture that day. It's hard to tell why he's so hostile and degrading to her. It's not that it strains credulity to find a misogynistic doctor or anything, but I can never get a handle on whether he's threatened by Mary's intelligence or grooming her into an abusive relationship. Mary agrees to at least take the $2,000 and show up, finding Beatrice and her niece Tessa, who works at the clinic and who has agreed to cover for them. She's played by Julia Maxwell with a great sarcastic vibe, and the sparring between her and Beatrice is amusing if shockingly profane. There's a lot of language thrown around in a very short time there. Mary also finds a woman calling herself Ruby Real Girl, who wants to make herself look like a living Barbie doll by having her nipples and labia removed and as much of her vulva sewn shut as can be safely managed. Wikipedia calls this colpaclesis in their plot summary, but the description we get on screen seems to better suit infibulation. Unfortunately, I'm not enough of a medical expert to really be able to pinpoint the differences, but both are real and achievable procedures, although it's important to note that female infibulation is done involuntarily in some cultures and is considered to be an abusive practice when performed without fully informed consent. Which is pretty much the angle Mary initially approaches it from. She doesn't have an obvious freakout or anything, but it's clear that she's never considered the notion that anyone would want to do something so drastic to their own body on purpose. But Ruby explains that she has a vision of herself as a person, a vision she doesn't see in the mirror, and that hurts and distresses her, and she needs this procedure to feel whole. And that's another one of this film's virtues and flaws, although in this case greatly more of a virtue than a flaw. It's definitely all about presenting body modification with sincere sympathy and understanding, and I love that there's almost none of the freak show aspect to this, even though I'm sure some of the very vanilla critics might see it that way. Yes, I'm looking at you, Rex Reed. But on the other hand, film is about drama, and there's not a whole lot of drama about the body modding despite it forming a pretty big chunk of the movie. Mary decides that, yep, bodies can be art, yep, people might want to change their appearances in very drastic ways, and that's about it for the conversation. Almost all of the body modification stuff in this movie, with one very obvious exception right at the end, is so positive it's actually kind of boring. Mary steps out for a moment to confirm with Beatrice that yes, Ruby really wants this, and no, she's not going to regret it in a couple of weeks, and just like that, she's performing the procedure right then and there without even checking to see if Ruby's got anything in her stomach that might react with a general anesthetic. Again, I love the 900-mile-per-hour swerves to the film, and I understand we've got a lot of material to get through before this is all over, but I just feel like this maybe needed a bit more setup before we're through it and on to the next plot point. This should have been its own episode, basically, but because it's a movie and not a TV show, the big moments don't get a chance to breathe. Oh yes, and Mary's playing Ave Maria again. Once is happenstance, twice is a coincidence, three times is a unifying motif, right? Speaking of moving fast, we cut directly from Mary throwing up into the toilet as soon as she gets home from performing her illegal surgery to Mary now in her residency program under Dr. Walsh. So we've jumped ahead possibly some months without explanation. Walsh tests her bedside manner by forcing her to inform a family of the death of the father due to cardiac arrest, and I'm really not clear whether these people are actors for her to practice on, or they really just had a med student walk out to deliver the bad news just to see how she'd do. I hope it's not the latter, because while we don't hear the dialogue, Mary doesn't exactly look like she's saying something comforting. Also, Dr. Walsh doesn't seem to be paying attention to how she's doing, which seems pretty important under the circumstances. After their rounds, Dr. Walsh compliments Mary on her skills and invites her to a party that he and Dr. Grant are holding with some of the other surgeons at Dr. Grant's house. She agrees to show up, wearing a dress given to her by Beatrice and Ruby as a thank you. She's trying not to socialize with the two women, despite Beatrice's best efforts to be friendly, but she does spend a little time on the web before the party looking at the various body modification sites out there and seeing her work on Ruby lauded and complimented by members of the community, to the tune of some obnoxiously edgy death metal. Honestly, this is kind of the anti-scream in that aspect. None of the needle drops work for me, and they all feel like they're trying so hard to be dark and sinister that they loop back around to campy and dumb. I think I'd like the whole movie more without them. The party has an ominous, sinister vibe almost as soon as Mary arrives, with a number of men already pawing at sex workers and a terrifyingly intense guest named Dr. Black, who's suspiciously vague about his exact surgical specialty. It's never overtly stated, but this is obviously the guy who flaked out on Billy that first fateful night at the club. Things seem to even out a bit when Walsh and Grant step in, but they're giving off some very predatory vibes themselves, and it's clear almost immediately that this is not a good place for a woman to be. But Mary's in an awkward position. Her residency depends on these men, and she can't afford to make them hostile towards her by overtly rejecting them. So she has a drink and makes small talk, until she finds out her drink has been drugged. There's no easy way to say it. At that point, Dr. Grant takes her to a back room and rapes her, filming the entire thing. It's not graphically depicted, but it's also not avoided either, and it's a deeply uncomfortable scene to watch. I think I understand why the Saskas chose to show the rape rather than simply implying it. This is going to be a turning point in Mary's life, and for it to be fully believable, I think you do need to understand her emotional state following this moment. But I do suspect it's where a lot of people nope out on this movie, and I don't blame them. Seeing Mary's open eyes and realizing she's still conscious enough to understand what Dr. Grant is doing to her is genuinely awful. By the way, I do have to mention it because it comes up several times as Dr. Grant's supposed motive. Apparently, he noticed Mary's sudden influx of unexplainable income and jumped to the conclusion that she'd turned to sex work to pay her bills, which made it acceptable in his mind to treat her this way. I kind of wish the Saskas didn't include that, because I think a lot of people will assume it's being done to humanize Dr. Grant and make his actions more understandable, but I am going to assume positive intent and read this as a commentary on the way people treat sex workers as less than human and make excuses to ignore crimes committed against them. Obviously, consenting to sex for money does not strip away your right to refuse consent to other things, and Grant is just a human monster who deserves, well, he deserves to face justice. We'll discuss whether he deserves everything that happens to him. The next morning, Mary goes to Billy and asks him how he'd like to make $5,000 for a change. And again, this is a place where a little more time and investment in the setup would really help, because it's implied that she's continued to work for Billy this entire time, earning money both by stitching up his gang when they need it, and by torturing people Billy needs injured with surgical precision, which is kind of a huge fucking deal that we only hear about after the fact and through implication. We then cut back to her apartment, where Lance and Billy are dropping off Dr. Grant. They tell her they'll stop back to pick him up when she's done with him, but she explains that won't be until tomorrow, and they can just go home. Mary explains to the heavily restrained doctor as she numbs his face with anesthetic that she's quit medical school to take up a new profession, illegal body modification for people with desires too extreme for the mainstream medical community. But if she's going to do that, obviously, she needs some practice. So she's going to try out some of the more common procedures she's going to be asked to do. On him. So we have tongue splitting? I know. Implants? Sometimes referred to as 3D implants? teeth filing, genital modification, and voluntary amputation. Thankfully, we don't see it play out, but the Foley work here is disturbingly realistic. And don't get me wrong, I have absolutely no sympathy for Dr. Grant. He is a serial rapist who's part of a ring of serial rapists, and I think he's better off removed from the world because I don't think there's any way to rehabilitate him, let alone to enact any kind of restorative justice on his many victims. It's not just that he's done something you can't atone for, it's that I legitimately cannot imagine that anyone who's gotten to this point in their existence can be made to understand why atonement would be necessary. I'm not bothered by his fate here. But it's such an over-the-top punishment, so gruesome and bizarre and outside of the normal everyday experience of the real world, that it goes at least a little bit into the realm of camp. It's absurd, and that emotionally distances you from the reality of the situation somewhat and makes it almost silly in a way that it honestly shouldn't be, given the visceral reality of the rest of the scenario. That's my problem with it. It turns Grant into a sick joke when I should be thinking of him as a serious monster. We then do another jump ahead to Mary seeing some of her patients in her unlicensed department medical practice. I'd quibble about the wisdom of this, but it's apparently more common than you might think to just do this stuff out of your home. One of them, Henrik, is there for his initial consultation, and when he says he's thinking about maybe getting some piercings, she calls him a 20-year-old Satanist wannabe reject and kicks him out. Mary, we are given to understand, does not do anything as boring as piercings. On her way out to see Beatrice, who's finally wearing her down with her persistently cheerful and friendly attitude, Mary's visited by a detective, Doller, who's looking into the disappearance of Dr. Grant. Dr. Alan Grant, apparently, which makes this whole sequence very difficult to take seriously because it's almost impossible to get the Jurassic Park theme out of your head after hearing that name. According to Doller, Dr. Walsh indicated that Mary might have some sort of grudge against Grant, although obviously these specifics were left highly vague because, oh yes, he raped her at one of our rape parties isn't something you say to a police investigator. But Doller's not dumb, and Grant left enough evidence behind to implicate him in a number of what the detective calls questionable activities, and it's clear he thinks Mary knows more even if he doesn't suspect her of having the man kidnapped so she could remove all of his appendages. Then we get a very weird scene. Over at the club, while Billy sits at his usual table, he sees Beatrice dancing and suddenly begins to envision her as Mary, pouring a whole glass of blood onto her chest in an erotic performance that I will say Catherine Isabel commits to wholeheartedly. But the weird thing about it is that it doesn't seem to be presented as a daydream or a fantasy. It's almost like Billy is having a psychotic episode, seeing other women as Mary and thinking that it's real. It's not the only time it happens, too. Mary shows up and makes a little small talk with Billy while she waits for Beatrice to finish dancing, and this is where we find out that, yep, she's become Billy's personal torturer, and he regularly uses her to inflict surgically precise agony on people, even though he doesn't have any work for her at the moment. If I have a single major criticism about this film, it's that it spends a lot of time on the body mod stuff, even though it doesn't have anything major to say about it beyond, yep, people should be allowed to do this stuff, it's their bodies, why do you think you should get a say in it? And very little time on Mary's job as a professional torturer for the Seattle mob. Again, very glad this film takes a non-judgmental approach to body modification, because even though it's very much not my thing, I believe that folks who are into it should be allowed to see themselves in the mirror the way they want to be, and it's not my job to tell them what to do. But man, is it the least interesting thing about this movie. Especially because they're bending so far backward to avoid making this seem potentially negative that they don't even get into the very real risks and consequences of being an unlicensed surgeon. Again, except for one very obvious moment at the end that we'll get to. Mary's never raided by the cops, she never has a single complication to any of her surgeries, she doesn't have any problems getting supplies or equipment, it's just smooth sailing, which makes a chunk of American Mary very undramatic. Which is a little weird when right next door we've got Mary tortures people for money and it's almost never dealt with. As if to demonstrate this, Beatrice casually mentions to Mary that even the hardened criminals at the Bourbon A Go-Go are terrified of her, while on the way to give her a business card for the German twins who run the body mod website Mary was looking at earlier. They're apparently quite impressed with her work and want to meet with her to discuss some elective surgery. The card is over at Ruby's, which doesn't make any logical sense because Beatrice specifically says that Ruby has been out of town for a while, and there's no reason she should have a card that Beatrice wants to give to Mary, but we need to work in the information that Ruby has a husband somehow, and this was the most naturalistic way the Saskas could think of. And speaking of the Saskas, it should come as no surprise that they're playing the German twins we're talking about. They meet with Mary at the Bourbon A Go-Go, caressing each other incestuously and paying one of the dancers $200 for a kiss that turns into a vicious bite. And I kind of feel like it muddles the feminist message of the movie when the director's self-insert is also treating sex workers like their suffering can be bought with cash. And they explain to Mary, who they call Bloody Mary, which was almost the title of the movie until it became obvious just how many horror movies have that title, that they want to exchange left arms as a sign of their undying connection to one another. And I think it might say something about me that my emotional response to that was, oh, okay, that's not as extreme as I was anticipating. I apparently have a very vivid imagination for this. They also want some extra subdermal implants to make them look more demonic, which is kept shrouded in mystery for just long enough to make it seem like it's going to be even bigger and more shocking than voluntarily amputating their own arms and swapping them before reattaching them, when it's very, very clearly not. Mary gets Billy to hook her up with another doctor to assist with the surgery, because it's a big job. There's a very limited time window for reattachment before tissue death sets in, and she has to do two of them. And then she does it. You know, no big deal. Double amputation, double reattachment, horns and fangs and ridges, thanks and good night. The twins will not feature in the movie again. There will be no complications resulting from this with the additional doctor who's been brought in on her practice. There will be no consequences to Mary's actions, positive or negative, beyond the spiffy new website the twins give her and the cash we see her using to get a nicer apartment for the rest of the movie. It's a little episodic, which again just strengthens my conviction that this would work so much better as a TV series, where this could be a one-off lighter story to contrast with some of the darker stuff. Like Billy, who kidnaps and murders Dr. Walsh. This was probably not a good idea on his part, but I suspect you don't wind up committing crimes for a living if you're great at evaluating risk-reward scenarios. Mary, meanwhile, goes to what looks like some kind of industrial storage facility with bare concrete floors and cinder block walls and a huge metal door to take photos of the work she did on Dr. Grant for her new website. He's dangling suspended from a pair of steel hooks dug into his back, and he's still alive, somewhat implausibly given that she sewed up his mouth and he's clearly not getting any kind of medical care beyond Mary's occasional visits. And honestly, I feel like we needed a lot more setup for this sequence because it poses a lot of logistical questions that the film is absolutely never going to answer. Like, what is this place? Is Mary renting it? Did she arrange this through Billy? If she didn't arrange this through Billy, how did she sneak Dr. Grant in here to begin with? And if she knows that this is not a sanctioned space to perform unlicensed surgery and criminal activities, why the hell does she leave the door open for just anyone to walk in? Because yeah, that's what happens. A security guard, whose existence Mary was presumably aware of when she signed in at the front desk of this building, knocks Mary out with his baton and lowers Dr. Grant to the ground as preparation for calling the cops on her. Apparently, she just felt like the expectation of privacy was good enough when it came to concealing the existence of her kidnapped torture victim that she knows the cops are actively searching for? This feels contrived, is what I'm trying to say. And it's contrived to no real purpose. Mary recovers in time to slash the guard's ankle with a scalpel, then beats him to death with his own baton, and even though Dr. Grant's managed to wriggle an impressive distance while she was occupied, he's still missing both arms and both legs, and it's not that difficult for Mary to subdue him. We later find out that she decided to kill Grant and dispose of both bodies, but the scene is so truncated that they don't even have time to show all that on camera. And the guard's death will never have any real impact on the story, besides providing what's quite possibly my favorite character interaction in the whole film. Back at Ruby's place, her husband, who's played by Travis Waters, finally finds out that she had her vulva sewn shut. He's not happy. I think this scene would make a little more sense if placed earlier, because Mary did the surgery on Ruby before she started her residency, and before she quit med school, and before she started her thriving body mod practice, and before Dr. Grant's mutilated body healed up to the point where she could just leave him in a dingy concrete basement. And honestly, if you're having sex with your wife so infrequently that you can go literal months, if not years, before noticing that she no longer has a place for you to insert your penis, then I think you're probably also a little too estranged to care about it, but what do I know? Also, infibulation is reversible. Obviously, that would have to be done against Ruby's will, and the implications of that are pretty terrible, but spoiler alert, this guy is clearly someone who has no problems doing terrible things to women, so I can't imagine him shrugging his shoulders and giving up on sex with his wife. After Mary takes care of the bodies, she and Lance have a little bite to eat, and he is just the sweetest and most emotionally comforting man in the whole wide world, as he tries to make her feel better about murdering a guy who did nothing wrong besides discovering her secret torture victim. He buys her takeout from three places, just so she has some options for food, and tells her about the guy who assaulted his mom and left her hospitalized for 4 months as part of a botched robbery. "What I wouldn't give to have known you back then when I found that motherfucker," he says, before telling her that she should never feel guilty for anything she's done. Which again, doesn't 100% apply to that poor security guard, but it's a very comforting message, and I love the way Holiday plays this scene. If this was a TV series, they'd have started writing a bigger role for him after this. Mary gets a nicer apartment, and we see some of her clients posing for photos to go on her website as her business really takes off. These are all authentic members of the body modding community in these brief cameos, and no special effects or makeup were used. Again, I'm not gonna lie, I love how respectful this movie is to the people who are into this. They're allowed to show off their bodies without judgment, which is really freaking cool. But of course there are now two doctors missing, with Mary as the common link between them, so Detective Doler stops by for a chat. Mary hides the evidence of her illegal surgical practice and tries not to let on that she already knew about Dr. Walsh's many, many videos of himself raping unconscious women, but it's hard to fully conceal her shock at finding out she's not on any of the tapes, and Doler clearly realizes something's going on. She briefly considers drugging and murdering him, but instead decides to play dumb until he gives up and leaves. For the moment. Presumably back to London? I don't know why he has a British accent if the whole movie was set in Seattle and filmed in Vancouver and the actor is from Chicago. It's just one of those little actor's choices that's inexplicable but fun. And this is also why it's something of a thankless role. He is not going to appear in this movie again until the final seconds, and he's not given any dialogue in those last few moments, so really he's just there to hover around the edges and not actually solve the crimes. Which is kind of an unfortunate thing if you're playing a detective in a crime thriller. The missing tape is in Billy's hands, and he's watching it to get off, but that's a plot thread that's never going to get any resolution, because we're rocketing toward the conclusion now. As soon as the detective leaves, Mary gets a call informing her that her grandmother has died, but we also don't get to spend any real time on that either, because Mary visits the club to talk to Billy and finds him getting a blowjob from one of the dancers. Billy admits to killing Dr. Walsh, but lies about the tape, and Mary discovers that she has feelings for Billy when she finds herself with a sudden impulse to carve up the sex worker who was being intimate with him using the surgical tool she now carries everywhere. She thinks better of it at the last moment, choosing instead to simply put the fear of God into this poor woman who might very well have been coerced into sex by her sleazy boss, but it's clear that she's developing a very different personality than the one she had at the beginning of the movie. Or possibly just unveiling one. But that doesn't get any resolution either, and neither does Billy's second psychotic break, where he goes from imagining Mary giving him a massage to picturing her stabbing him to death with a scalpel. Because when she goes home, still thinking over Billy's offer to spend a couple of weeks driving down the coast and getting away from their work, Ruby's husband is there waiting for her. He tortured her address out of Beatrice, who he realized must have paid for Ruby's surgery, and it's about here that we mentally revisit the conversations in the vet clinic and realize that the reason Beatrice couldn't find a surgeon to operate on Ruby was because they were all afraid of her violent and unpredictable husband, and Mary was very much used for her naivete and inability to understand the risks of what she was doing. Which again, would have loved some more development to that, but not to sound like a broken record, this movie does not have time to unpack all of its fascinating plot. The possessive husband stabs Mary in the stomach, and although she manages to inflict a fatal injury on her attacker, she's bleeding badly and medical help would arrive too late. Ave Maria plays one last time as she crawls to her surgical suite and tries to stitch the wound up herself. But of course, that's impossible even for the most brilliant doctor never to graduate from med school, and she dies. We see Detective Doler and a host of forensic techs going through her apartment and uncovering her secrets, and she dies an underappreciated genius in her chosen art. The final shot is of her lying on the bloody floor, a last smile on her face. And the consensus opinion among fans of this movie is that nope, the last 20 minutes just didn't happen. And not just because Catherine Isabel makes Mary Mason somehow surprisingly sympathetic despite her multiple murders, and we want her story to have a happy ending. This is just a story that's too big and sprawling and interesting to end as quickly as it does, and Mary's death really feels more like the Saskas ran out of time to explore this whole fascinating world and just said, well, gotta wrap this up. And killing Mary off definitely wrapped it up. It's an unsatisfying way to conclude the movie, even if you do think Mary deserves some kind of comeuppance, because her death has nothing to do with the mob torture or the kidnapping and mutilation of her former professor or even the murder of the innocent security guard. It's kind of random. And while death in the real world usually is, we kind of like to have a little more structure to our fiction. I'm glad the Saskas are taking another crack at this one in a long-form medium, because I think it'll really benefit from the extra space. And because who knows, maybe Mary will get to live this time. And will I hang on to this movie? Yes. Despite all the flaws I mentioned, I'd rather have a film that tries to do too much than one that tries to do too little, and this is an ambitious and interesting movie with an amazing performance from Catherine Isabel. She makes opacity a virtue, giving Mary interesting silences and intriguingly blank looks. And I like spending time in this world with these people in a way that makes the movie very rewatchable. Until we get that TV show, this is definitely the best American Mary we have, and it's worth hanging on to. And if you want to talk about body modification, inexplicable British accents, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, we've gotten through 1-2 Freddy's Coming for You, so let's get to work on locking that door as we tackle what's probably the most popular installment of the series, A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. See you then.